Five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski.
The whole thing is very mysterious, but this is what I know.
Authorities say a menacing letter received yesterday by a Vallejo newspaper was not sent by the infamous Zodiac killer. Betsy Gebhardt has details.
That Area 51, the secret Air Force base in Nevada, actually exists.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
He's been called the East Side Rapist. He's been called the Visalia Ransacker, the original Night Stalker, and the Golden State Killer.
You have now entered into the House of Mystery, the best in true crime, conspiracy, and alternative history, with Al Warren and Kevin Thompson. KCAA, the stations that leave no listener behind. Broadcasting on 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM. The trifecta of talk radio for Southern California.
Okay, welcome back into the House of Mystery on day 558 of the Crazy Train. And joining me today is our cop on duty, Kev Thompson.
Hello, everybody. How's it going?
Yeah, another day. Another hot day. Not supposed to be as hot today in Bellevue. I think it's only going to get up to 80. But it's all good. Now, we're going to continue on true crime here, and this week I've been getting a lot of requests for to talk more about the Green River Killer, to think about it, we haven't really touched off on this. So we actually got someone that was very close and involved, and he's moved on from being sheriff at from the time of the crime and everything, but now he is a congressman. So I know he's busy. Thank you for taking the time. It's David Reichardt.
Yes, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
So, David, you were the sheriff, and you were kind of in law enforcement at the time of the Green River Killer, and that was quite a time. I mean, he get convicted of 49 and got didn't he admit to like 71 killings or something?
He initially pled guilty to 48, and then a couple of years later, another body was found, and he pled guilty to that. So he actually pled guilty to 49 murders. We closed 51 cases, and he said he killed somewhere between 60 and 70.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, listening to your book, I've listened to most of it, and throughout, there was a lot of times that the press were kind of a little bit more on the attack of law enforcement at the time, and they're kind of not the the most sympathetic, I would guess. But they sort of put it toward, because a lot of the girls were prostitutes or runaways that nobody really cared, and the police didn't really care about solving it. But I can tell by the book and the way you wrote, that's not necessarily true.
No, absolutely not true. You know, every investigator, every volunteer, every scientist, every support person that worked on that case over the 19 years that it took to catch this guy were all dedicated, compassionate, caring people. And yes, you know, I know the public during those years was especially frustrated, especially people who were street people, frustrated that the case wasn't being solved as quickly as everyone wanted it to be solved. But it wasn't because the detectives, the police department, the sheriff's office didn't care. It was because of the nature of the case. And so if you could imagine, first of all, if you were a detective in that case, it'd be very difficult for you to put your, I mean, if you're not a detective, but you try to put yourself in that place, it's very difficult to do. It's, unless you've lived through an experience like that, it's even hard for me to explain what it's like to go to work every day and collect body after body. In some weeks, we collected 4, 5, and 6 bodies a week, and then you would go home and go to sleep and wonder and hope and pray that when you woke up, someone else was not killed. So we had a mission to catch this guy, and we were collecting, all the while, collecting the bodies of little girls, because we're talking about most of the victims were from 16 to 38, so we had little girls to young women, and imagine the toll it took on the families who had missing daughters. Mm-hmm. The toll that it took, well, waiting to hear, you know, whether or not their daughter was one of the found remains, set of remains. Imagine the toll that it took on the families who then learned that their daughter was one of the victims. And then also, you can't forget the toll on the community, but the toll on the detectives is one that sometimes people forget. And I know, talking to investigators today even, and myself included in this, is these are not memories that can be erased. These are memories that you live with, right, for the rest of your life.
And they haunt you, because forever you're always wondering, did I do the right thing, or is there more that I could have done? Or, you know, so much of it just haunts you, and case after case after case, and it just builds up.
Yeah, so I started this case in January of 1982. I was assigned one of the first investigations, death investigations of a young girl, 16, who was found strangled and was in the human trafficking trade. Then in July, the Kent Police Department was assigned a case in their jurisdiction. And then in August, on August 12th, I was assigned another young girl, a teenage girl, who was found in the river. And then on August 15th, three more bodies. Two bodies were found by a river rafter, and as I was processing the scene on August 15th, 1982, found another body, Opal Mills, on the riverbank. So that was the beginning of really the intensive investigation. We knew on August 16th, 1982, after collecting 4 bodies over the weekend, that we had a serial murder on our case, mm-hmm. in our jurisdiction, and it was a serial murder case. As we moved through that case, imagine, here's the difficulty of a case like this. So we had 10,000 items of evidence eventually collected. We had over 40,000 tip sheets. We didn't have computers back then. We got our first computer in 1986, and it didn't correlate information. All it could do is collect information. So we were doing everything basically from hard copy documents to try and follow up this information. And Ridgway, all he had to do was to drive up to a street corner, open the door, make a deal with whoever was working on the street. They jumped in the car. They disappeared into the night. And then the witnesses that we had to interview were street people.
And they're a little hesitant to talk to the police anyways.
And exactly, so hesitant to talk to the police. They didn't want to be arrested for something that they might be involved in. They weren't really paying attention to who was coming and going, because that was the way of the street. You got in a car, you came back, you got in a car, you came back. Sometimes you get in a car and not come back, and then they would see you the next day. The people that we were interviewing on the street, for example, some of them had multiple names, multiple addresses, connected to multiple different cars, different license plate numbers, inaccurate license plate numbers, inaccurate birth dates, and other identifying information, always moving from place to place, changing their appearance, Even the victims in our case had multiple names, and so trying to track them down, as you can imagine, was difficult. Mm-hmm. So he was in the perfect storm, so to speak, where there was so much activity going on and such a confusing underworld that he was able to operate in that world for quite some time without anybody really being drawn to suspect him as the person.
And that was that was something I was going to say, Congressman, is, you know, Al asked the question, and it's a very valid point. You know, whenever you believe you have a serial killer in your community, you know, the public is scared, and you know that fear, you know, leads to other thoughts. But in this case, the public needs to understand that when you're dealing with individuals who are involved in prostitution, they are very difficult to investigate because of their nomadic lifestyle. And they do. They change their appearance. They change their names. Oftentimes, they're runaways. And you don't know who their family is, so they're very difficult to connect to somebody. What makes them so difficult to investigate is what makes them such a perfect victim to a serial killer.
Well, right, yeah, and it's what we discovered, and I think today, you know, that we have come a long way in recognizing how to interact with young people who have been moved to, you know, sort of forced out onto the street. I was a runaway when I was a senior in high school because I grew up in a family, the oldest of seven, with domestic violence, and so I could identify with these kids to a certain degree as having to leave my home because of violence at home. So the vast majority, not all of the victims in this case, but the vast majority of these young girls and young women left their homes because they were being physically, sexually, emotionally abused. Again, not all of them, but a large percentage of them. They ended up on the street, and they were, again, victimized by the people on the street. So back in those days, they had people who would connect to young girls in the human trafficking world who were called pimps. And they would take their money, they would drive them around, they would find clients for them, and so they were taken advantage of at home, or they were victimized at home, I should say. They were victimized by the pimps on the street, who then, of course, put them in a situation where they were victimized by the people who were buying the prostitutes, the Johns, the Tricks. And then what happened is, you know, also kind of a sad circumstance in this chain of events of being victimized is that the judicial system then victimized them one more time because we treated them as criminals, when in fact these are young girls who needed our help, who were victims really in this whole affair. And today I think we've moved past, you know, saying, well, you're a prostitute, you're a drug addict, you're an alcoholic, we're going to arrest you and we're going to take you to juvie. Today, you know, we recognize that these are young girls, these are children, mm-hmm. that need our help, and we need to get them back into a caring, loving home and help them get their, you know, get back on their feet.
You know, and again, you know, I work in law enforcement, and I've worked in corrections for quite some time, and I've met a lot of these young women who, you know, do work the streets. And you're right, Congressman, they are women, they're daughters, they're mothers, and they do need to be treated like ladies. Having said that, it must have been very difficult when a family is missing a daughter who has fallen into this type of lifestyle, and then you've got to show up at the family's door and tell them that they have become a victim of a killer. What was that experience like, and what was their response? And was it a relief inside of a tragedy? At least they know where their daughter is. I mean, are you understanding the question?
Yeah.
You know, because sometimes the worst thing is not knowing.
Yes, it's been a question that's been asked, I lost track of how many times over the number of years, but it is by far one of the most difficult parts of the job. You know, I can think of prior to my involvement in the Green River case and having to be part of a case that is so difficult in so many ways. I can remember having to maybe make notifications once or twice in my career that someone in a family, that a family member has passed away. In this case, it seemed like it was once a week or once every 2 weeks that you were knocking on somebody's door saying, we have identified your daughter and she is not alive any longer. It is one of the most difficult. Imagine saying that, 50 times to 50 different families or 60 different families, because some of the families some of the victims in this case we were including in the Green River serial murder list of victims, but some eventually fell outside of that, and some of the cases were individually solved. Some today are still not solved, but we still made those notifications. Most of the detectives who were working on these cases, including the missing persons cases, so we, during the length of this investigation, found over 2,500 missing women over the course of this investigation, and solved multiple rape cases and other criminal cases. So you become very well acquainted with community, and especially with the families who have missing young girls, especially with the families who then have learned that their daughter's been killed by Ridgway. In your career, you're told by your superiors as you're, become a new officer, don't get emotionally involved.
Yes, but it's difficult. But, you're dealing with such raw emotion.
Yeah, there's no way. And I mean, I was at a funeral at one of the victims' memorial services. I've attended many of the memorial services back during the investigation, and still maintain relationships with some of the family members even today. And, one thing that we also learned as we kind of grew and matured through this case was that people still today, even in this country, we say that, well, at least the families have closure. But one thing I've learned for these families that have lost their dear daughter, their loved one, is that there is never closure. The only thing they ever get is answers to questions that, is my daughter one of the victims? Did Ridgway kill my daughter? And we can, because of how we handled this case, we can answer that question for 51 of the families. We can say yes, and they have, again, all they have is an answer to the question, because they have forever lost their daughter. Mm-hmm. And I know one family who for many, many years kept their daughter's bedroom exactly how it was when they reported her missing.
I would. I'm saying that honestly, Congressman. I definitely would. I agree, that this interview should concentrate on the victims and the victims' families and the police work that went into this. But we would be remiss if we didn't address Ridgway just a little bit. Mm-hmm. He was married. And yeah. How did his wife take the news when detectives began questioning her, saying that your husband is a suspect? Or we have now, how did she take it when he was convicted?
Yeah, she was surprised. And of course, she was very thoroughly interviewed, and were convinced that she had no knowledge of what was going on. This is not unusual, you know. Ridgway, in this particular case, so I'm not an expert in serial murder investigations, but I'm going to say I am an expert in the Green River case.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, growing up on it, but Ridgway picked his victims because they were vulnerable, they had low self-esteem, and they were easy prey. And his wife was vulnerable. He picked someone who had low self-esteem and was basically just happy to have a home, roof over her head, food, and unusual in this case is that Gary Ridgway actually kept a job for 30 some years, worked at the same place. And what he did was he would say to his wife, I'm going to go home late. I'm going to be coming home late from work. It's none of your business why.
Oh, wow.
I'll be going in early, and it's none of your business why. So she never asked any questions. And in some cases, for example, on one occasion, Ridgway, driving to work, picked up a young girl and had sex with her, killed her, put her in the back of his pickup truck, which had a canopy on top, drove to work, parked it in the work parking lot, went in and worked for 4 hours, came out at lunchtime, got into his truck, took it to a dead-end road, got in the back of the truck, had sex with the dead body, drove back to work, and finished his shift out, got back in his truck at the end of the shift, and on the way home, he found a place to put the body and drove home. And that night, he kissed his wife hello and had dinner and went to bed like any other normal person might do. However, he had just taken the life of a 16-year-old young girl.
And he was just that casual about it. I mean, that's sociopath. You know, they're unable to empathize. I mean, that's astonishing, you know? You leave work, you go out to lunch, and you kill a person.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
There's no remorse.
Now, he was tested, and his IQ was running right around 80. How did he get away for so long?
Yeah, so, I mean, he has no remorse. First of all, as you mentioned, the life of a person that really meant nothing to him. And there was an unusual relationship with his mother, as most... Again, I'm not an expert in all serial murders, but in most of that I've read about and studied, there is some sort of an unusual relationship with the mother that tends to, bend certain people toward this kind of behavior. He had no respect for his mother, had no respect for women, and that's how he kind of moved forward from that point. But the way that he avoided detection, was really... back in those days, you have to remember again that, the scientific forensic science was really only in its early stages. We still, we used fingerprints, of course, but remember, most of the clothing was taken.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing left behind at the scenes, really, that could be fingerprinted, although we did find items that we consider possibly associated with crime scenes and fingerprinted those, but not always coming up with anything that was discernible, nothing that matched anything in the NCIC database. DNA was not a science until the late 90s.
Oh, Lord, it's still not.
So DNA is what helped us solve the case, but we were only looking. So here's how we solved it. In 1982, on the riverbank, we had victims who still had were intact, physically intact bodies, and we were able to collect some bodily fluids from them. which were not of their own, but left by behind by the suspect. Those were frozen in a test tube. That was 1982. In 1987, Ridgway came up as a suspect. We searched his house. We searched his place of work. And we were able to get the judge to allow us to take a body sample, a body fluid sample. So we had him chew on a gauze, put it in a test tube, and we froze it. So we have frozen spermatozoa samples from 1982. We have frozen saliva sample from 1987. But if we were to have those examined in that day and age, the only thing that we could get from them would be a blood type. Possibly.
Mm-hmm. Carol,
that wasn't
karyotyping.
That wasn't assured. Yes. So we proceeded forward. We had other items of evidence that came up that we thought might lead to identifying a suspect. Very microscopic glass beads was one of the things that we spent a lot of time tracking down. They were found at some of the sites, and we discovered that those glass beads, microscopic glass beads, were actually glass beads that were used in painting the white stripes along the roadways and the yellow stripes in the middle of the roadways to make them reflect, and that most people in our community, almost all of us, matter of fact, have these glass, microscopic glass beads attached to our socks and the bottoms of our pants and our shoes. So,
oh, wow.
Of course, they didn't lead anywhere. So we continued to collect, as I said, 10,000 items of evidence. Then in 1998-99, we became aware of the science of DNA. We took those samples. A detective actually personally transported those to the East Coast. There were only two labs then that did DNA testing. They looked at them and said, your samples are so minute and so fragile, we want to wait until the science proceeds forward. We don't want to destroy them. So we continued to freeze them. And in 2001, in March, we submitted those samples. We got a call from the lab saying we can do it now. We submitted those samples, and on September 10th of 2001, the day before 9/11, Detective Tom Jensen, who was still on the case back in 2001, and I was the sheriff now by this time, and I had reopened the case when I became sheriff in 1997, and started an evidence review team, and we began to kind of relook at things again, and it had been shut down because of budgetary issues, and people felt we weren't going to solve the case. Tom submitted the DNA evidence to the lab. On September 10th, Tom came to my office, and he pulled an envelope out with the DNA graphs on two of the victims. They matched. And then he pulled out Ridgway's gauze DNA analysis, and it matched. And so we then, of course, began to plan how we were going to arrest Ridgway. We followed him, put him under surveillance for a couple of months. He hit on one of our undercover females who were out
yes.
on the street. Yeah, our decoy. And we arrested him because we didn't, you know, we didn't want to lose him and take the chance that he would actually
or
kill
lose
someone
her.
Else again. Yeah, or lose her. So then after that, you know, it was a long process of 6 months of interrogation with his attorneys present. You know, him wanting to save his life. And us wanting to solve as many cases as we could, in order to give the families the answers that they were all asking. One of the hardest things I've ever done on this case, too, I should mention, is to spend a Friday, Saturday, and a Sunday in a hotel room and visit with each one of the family members. Well, members from each one of the families that were on the list, it approached near 60, to tell them that we were going to seek a deal with Ridgway to avoid the death penalty. That was their attorney's his attorney's request. In return, take us to the sites of additional bodies, and take us to the sites where he dumped bodies. And our whole purpose in that was to give answers to as many families as we could as to what happened to their daughters. And that was a long 3-day
wow
weekend.
I can only imagine, Congressman. A couple of points for the listeners. I can't say this enough. First of all, DNA evidence, it is nothing like you see on television, you know, where they plug in a DNA sample and while Blondie's brushing her hair on CSI, they get a DNA match. It could take months. It can literally take months to get a DNA match. But let's move on to your last point there that you just made. That's devastating. To make a plea agreement with him, let's look at the numbers. We've got 48 victims. You pinned a 49th on him, but he's admitting to at least 71. Was he keeping those, do you think, in those others in reserve to make a deal like this? Because you know how they like to stretch that out. I'll make a deal with you, and I'll show you where these other bodies are.
Well, one thing about Ridgway is that he's a pathological liar. So I think sometimes, at least we felt as investigators, that he was having trouble discerning truth from fiction in his own world that he lives mm-hmm. in. But I think we also believe that there were certain things that he was holding back, certain cases that he was not admitting to. I don't think any of us doubt that he was keeping secret for whatever reason. We don't know. It could be that there was some special occurrence during that particular murder that he committed that he wanted to keep to himself. And, you know, sadly, I know this is a tragic thought, that, I mean, part of the reason that he can survive in his 8-foot by 8-foot cell 23 hours a day, because he only gets out 1 hour a day at Walla Walla Penitentiary, is that he relives these cases in his mind, and especially those that he didn't share with us. But again, you know, we made a decision to do this. We felt it was the right thing to do. The King County prosecutor, Norm Mailing, at the time, and myself as the sheriff, and meeting with the detectives, there wasn't, as far as I can remember, one detective that was a naysayer as far as trying to solve as many cases as we could. And not because we wanted to be, you know, to say for our own benefit and to say that, you know, we solved, 49 cases or 51 cases, but to give these answers to the family so they could have memorial services for their daughters, and they could understand now what actually happened to them. Again, trying to move on with their lives, but all the while that piece of their life, that important person in their life, that child that they had in their home, was ripped out of their house, but also ripped out of their heart, and that's a hole that can never be plugged. And so we felt like we needed to answer that question for them, at least so they could move forward with their lives in some form or fashion. Because the choices that we had, you know, plead guilty to 7. We ended up with 7 cases, 4 on DNA and 3 on paint evidence. Let me explain the paint evidence cases real quickly, because mm-hmm. there was a new science associated with investigating paint evidence also that came into our into view, and that was, we had 3 cases with 3 pieces of clothing that contained microscopic paint spheres, not paint chips, but microscopic paint spheres. The microscopic paint spheres in one case were attached to a blouse that we found that had been buried for 6 years and was so decomposed that it would crumble in your fingertips as you picked it up. And so microscopic paint spheres were found on these microscopic decomposing fibers that had been buried for 6 years. This is how thorough we were. And our scientists at the Washington State Lab just did an outstanding, magnificent job examining all these samples and coming up with the DNA and the paint samples. The second piece of clothing was a ligature that was tied around Wendy Caulfield's throat. She was found in July of 1982, and she was in the river for over 2 weeks. So you have the river washing over this piece of cloth, but still embedded in the cloth was the microscopic paint spheres. The third piece of clothing was one found just downriver from Cynthia Hines, and I would say it's probably half a mile to a mile downriver. So as Ridgway left the site after he left Cynthia Hines behind, he drove down the Frager Road and threw that piece of clothing out the river. We didn't know it at the time that it was connected, but we collected it just in case. That piece of cloth, that blouse, contained microscopic paint spheres. We had seven cases. Those seven cases we could go to trial on, and he could be found guilty, and then go to the penalty phase, and the jury, of course, has two decisions to make. One, put him to death. If they chose to put him to death, in our state, he would never be put to death. There would just be appeal after appeal after appeal. So now we got Yuri Ridgway.
We know how that feels.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So you got him, you know, guilty on seven, and we don't have answers. He's not going to talk about the others as long as he's still alive in prison. He could be found guilty, and the jury decide to not put him to death, because all it takes is one, as you know, in the penalty phase, one juror to say, I just can't put anybody to death, and he doesn't get the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And then the third option, of course, was that he could be, even as bizarre as it might sound to some of your listeners, he could be found not guilty. And all you have to do is take a look at the O.J. Simpson case, and just kind of go, oh my gosh. So we decided to make sure that we could get all the information, all the details, as much as we could on every case. And I have to, you know, the team of detectives. Again, I just want to give so much credit to the entire team. I happen to be the face of the case. I was the initial detective assigned to first bodies. I was the lead investigator in the case, and I ended up as the sheriff reopening the case again and then solving it while I was the sheriff. So I just happen to be the name and the face associated with this thing over the 19-year period. But I'll tell you, Tom Jensen is a guy that stuck with this case for many, many, many years, and has managed the information, compared and correlated information over the years. The people that interviewed Ridgway and all of us who were in those rooms that had the TV feeds into the interviews, and we would shoot questions into the four detectives, the main detectives that interviewed Ridgway. We were all a part of that. And I can't stress enough the dedication, compassion, the persistence of each and every person involved in this case. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make that point. And then and also to your listeners, that there are still little girls out there, and boys, little boys for that matter today, on the streets. They're runaways. They're living under the freeways. They're being taken advantage of. They're being assaulted. They're being manipulated. We have people who are involved in the human trafficking world still today. And these are our children, you know. I mean, our children together, and we need to make an effort to find a way to stop human trafficking, to stop our young people from being victimized. And then lastly, remember the families. And sadly, you know, one of the ways for me, I have the memories of finding the bodies and collecting the bodies and sifting through the remains, scores and scores and scores of dead bodies of little girls and young women. Mm. But if your listeners could even think about, imagine, I even hate to suggest this, but imagine if your daughter was one of the victims in this case, how you would feel, and place that feeling on the victims' families, because that's how they feel today. The loss is so great they can never overcome it. And this is our job, to try to prevent these things from happening.
Yes, sir. You know, and sir, Congressman, allow me to thank you. As a congressman and as a sheriff, you reopened this case. I want to thank you for your dedication to bringing closure to this case. And I honestly can't say that I remember another sheriff that sat down for 3 days in a hotel room and spoke specifically, individually with victims' families. Thank you for that. That was unique and very, very appreciated. I do know this, and I know that we're drawn to a close, Congressman. Two real quick things. I do know that investigators or sheriffs oftentimes, in facing the media at the close of a case, don't get to say everything that's on their heart. And we here at the House of Mystery, I'd like to give you a minute or two to maybe say those things that were on your heart that you didn't get to say then. Would you like to take that opportunity?
Well, I thank you for having me on to tell this story, and I hope your listeners really got a flavor of how hard this is for the families to move on, and what a tragedy it is for them to lose their little girls. Understand that there are young girls and young boys out there today that are in those same positions, and tragically some of those lives are being taken each and every day. And then lastly, again, just to think about law enforcement today and the criticism that it's taking. I know these men and women. I've worked with these men and women not only in my 33-year career in the sheriff's office here in Seattle, but also in my 14 years in Congress, I've worked with them. And I would say that for the vast majority of men and women in law enforcement, they are people who are there because they want to serve. They are willing to put their lives on the line. They are willing to see the ugly side of the world that we live in today to protect those law-abiding citizens from having to see the ugliness that happens day in and day out. I was a part of the team that collected those bodies over the years and went after this killer and tried to collect the evidence because we cared about each and every human being that was connected to this case. It didn't matter to us what the economic stature of the family was, what their racial background was, what their religion was. And in today's world, we are judging people by all of those things. We are all human beings, equal in our freedoms given to us by one person, and that's God. And those are rights and freedoms that our founding fathers based our Constitution on. Mm-hmm. That they weren't rights that were granted to us by our government, but they were inalienable rights granted to us by our Creator. And each and every one of us should be looking at each other as equal creations in this world and should be treating each other with respect, and especially those men and women who are putting their lives on the line to protect our families. And I thank you for the opportunity to allow me to say those things.
Thank you for being on the show. I know that you're agents biting at the bit here to get you off. So we appreciate you being here, and anytime you want to come back and talk more, please let us know.
Yep, you just let us know. We'll be happy to come back on. Thanks.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Coming up next, Stephen David Lampley delivers his true crime commentary.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
Welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. I am Stephen David Lampley. All right, listen, we're going to continue our discussion of blood spatter today with part three of the forensics of blood spatter analysis. Now, there are handouts available on this blood spatter series. If you go to www.stephendavidlampley.com/handouts with an S, StephenDavidLampley.com/handouts. You'll see the handout there. We have made special preparations for this to be very user-friendly. You can read it online and follow along with us, or you're welcome to print it out. We have made it printer-friendly with margins. It is friendly for black and white or color printers, so feel free to do as you wish with those. Okay, so let's start this discussion with area of convergence. Now, the area of convergence is the starting point of the blood before it hit the surfaces of the crime scene. Simplified, it is the taking of the blood spatter on the crime scene surfaces and then determining where the blood source was located when the spatter occurred. Now, in detail, and this is on the handout as well, in detail, it involves investigators determining the angle from which each droplet of blood hit the object by using strings to project that angle outward into space. Now, by doing this with each blood droplet, a common point will begin showing itself as the strings begin to meet at a common focal point out in that space. This is what is called the area of convergence. It shows where the victim was located when the spatter occurred. Now, we know that's how investigators identify the victim's location during the blood spatter. Let's discuss some of the common bloodstain patterns. Now, these are also on the handout. Arterial spatter. Now, when an artery is severed, it typically spurts out blood under pressure by the heartbeat pressure. Arterial patterns have a specific and distinctive pattern. Typically, they're arched with multiple areas created from each beat of the heart. It's a very, very distinctive pattern. Another pattern is what we call cast-off, and that is created by blood that is deposited on a weapon, such as a hammer or club. When there is blood on an object and the object is swung, it can throw off or cast off some of the blood that is on the object onto surrounding surfaces. Now, this, of course, is called a cast-off pattern. The direction that the object was swung can be determined by the spatter pattern it leaves. And by counting the number of arched patterns, we'll reveal the number of strikes that were hit on the victim. Another pattern is what we call a wipe pattern. A wipe pattern is simply created by an object that is moved through an existing stain and leaving a wipe pattern behind. And we have something called a pattern transfer, and it is created when blood comes in contact with another object, and then some of the blood transfers, or is wiped off, if you will, onto that object. We have something called a body image pattern. Now, this occurs when a body has been lying on the ground or on the floor or some object, and the blood pools around the body, creating a pattern showing the position of where the body was lying. All right, we are out of time again. I hope you were able to take something away from this today. I hope you learned something. We will be back next time with part 4 of the Blood Spatter series. I look forward to talking to you then.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.